Welcome to Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson, inviting you to explore ideas about how you can enjoy a better way of life from one of today's top experts in quantum consciousness. Cynthia Sue Larson is a life coach and the best-selling author of Quantum Jumps, Reality Shifts, High Energy Money, and Aura Healing Meditations, who has been publishing the free monthly Reality Shifters e-zine since 1999 through realityshifters.com. Living the Quantum Dream with Cynthia Sue Larson is part of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Cynthia Sue Larson, and our guest today is Stephen A. Schwartz. Stephen A. Schwartz is a distinguished consulting faculty member of Saybrook University, a research associate of the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, and columnist for the peer-reviewed research journal Explore. The author of 4 books and more than 100 technical papers, he has also written articles for Smithsonian, Omni, American History, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Huffington Post. He lives in Langley, Washington. Welcome, Stephen.
Welcome, Cynthia. Nice to be here.
Oh, great. Well, you've truly been in a remarkable position to observe some of the most sweeping historical changes, including attending civil rights speeches, such as the famous I Have a Dream speech by Dr. Martin Luther King. And I've heard some people comment that the time for social change is over, that people today don't get involved in causes the way they used to. I'd love to know your take on that, because I know you're quite the futurist, and you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on worldwide.
Well, I would say that let me reframe it. I think we're going to see the greatest social change that we have seen in living memory. I too wondered initially why we didn't see more people out in the streets at some of these things that have gone on. Part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that when we were doing the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement in the 70s, the internet didn't exist. And so the way people expressed themselves was in sort of mass movements, which I still think are very effective, as we recently saw at the University of Missouri. That said, I think the use of social media has also provided a way for group consciousness to express itself that provides some of the energy that civil rights demonstrations provided. So I don't think that I don't think we're in an era where there is no change. I think we're at an era where there is enormous change, simply expressed differently. And also there are other factors that are in play. I mean, just to quickly go through a list of the changes that we're going through, starting at the sort of largest level, the geopolitical, we are seeing a change at the geopolitical level, which is as great as the creation of nation states at the end of the 19th century. You know, most people think countries have existed as they are for centuries, if not millennia, but the truth is many of the European countries didn't come into existence until the end of the 19th century, and there was a massive reorganization of countries after the First World War when 4 major empires who thought they were going to last forever disappeared. I mean, who remembers the Ottoman Empire anymore or the Austro-Hungarian Empire?
Right. And that's a really good point. This is pretty recent, relatively.
And the nation states are a relatively recent phenomena in their sort of present format. What we're seeing now is a transfer of power away from nation states and into the virtual corporate states that we call multinational corporations, who really control a great deal of the political process. I mean, just consider for just one moment as an example, we have 9 billionaires in the United States who audition candidates, who come to kiss their ring and see if they can get money from them. I think about that. I mean, imagine that we have candidates who audition amongst the uber rich. So that's a pretty significant change.
But it kind of reminds me a little bit of the royalty and the royal families that were in existence.
Well, that is what's happening.
Yes.
We're having the new feudalism. Neo-feudalism is arising, where you have 400 people who own as much wealth as 3.8 billion people, about a little over half the planet. You have 85 people in the United States who have as much wealth as about 60% of the rest of the American public. So we are creating, most people don't recognize, when they do studies and they ask people to list how rich the rich are and how poor the poor are, the differential that they report is really relatively small compared to the truth of it. So the what has happened is we have an uber class that are arising, who with a wealth inequity and a power inequity that is every bit as bad as the feudal era. So we have this new aristocracy growing. You know, they're just, we are in such great flux. We see, for instance, just to list a few trends that are going on right now. For the first time in 500 years, being born white won't confer privilege. And Anglo-American European cultural values are no longer going to determine how the world is organized. The rise of India, China, Asian countries, Malaysia, is changing the power equation and the cultural equation.
Yes. Well, it seems like there's a lot to be concerned about. When you present it this way, it seems that there should be every reason for people to sit up and take notice, especially in supposed democracies and countries that supposedly are featuring, this whole different way of doing things rather than some kind of a new aristocracy. But with regard to movements such as the Occupy movement, because I think a lot of people joined that movement hoping to show that they are part of the 99%. That was a catchphrase that caught on. But I like some of the terminology you're using because it seems so much more powerful to evoke the real reality of what's going on. This is neo-feudalism, and are people okay with that? So I was wondering.
Well, they're not okay with it. I mean, they're miserable with it. You look at study after study showing, for instance, in the United States, that confidence in the institutions of government is barely into double digits. And in some areas, it's not into double digits. So we are in a state of enormous flux. And the reason I wrote the 8 Laws of Change was to provide people with science-based information about how individuals and small groups can bend the arc of history to a more compassionate and life-affirming outcome. Because many of the trends that we are facing now, if we continue as we are, have been doing, the outcomes are extremely bleak.
And, well, I love that your book, The 8 Laws of Change, it's an extraordinary book because it really does show, as the subtitle indicates, that you can be an agent of personal and social transformation, which I think people need to feel empowered at this time. And while success clearly comes with all 8 of these, I was wondering if there are some of these that you feel are currently most transformative and most essential, or ones that people could jump onto and start adopting? Sometimes when there are eight things is a lot, but if there's just one or two they could start with.
Well, I actually would start with something even more basic than the eight laws. I'll do the eight laws too, but the central and most important thing that your listeners can do, and to give you a sense of the power that this represents, let me say that if the people who are listening to your show will do as I now suggest, we could change the outcome of the 2016 election. So how's that for change?
Well, it sounds impressive. I'd love to hear what you have to say. What is the central thing that we can do first?
Here it is. When you make a decision through the course of the day, what I call quotidian choices, little daily mundane choices, first of all, be aware that you're making a choice. Now, surprisingly, studies show that most people are not, in fact, aware that they're making choices. They just go in and, you know, for instance, they go into the supermarket and they buy the toothpaste that their mother bought when they were little, or that some friends introduced them to in college or whatever. They just sort of do it unconsciously, as it were. And they do, all of us, we do hundreds of things like that all through the day. We make purchases, we make choices without actually being aware we're making a choice and that there are implications to that choice. So the first thing you have to do is be aware you're making a choice. And the second thing you want to do is to say to yourself, A, I'm making a choice, and B, of the options that are available to me as I understand them in this moment, that I will make the choice that is the most compassionate and life-affirming. Now, none of the choices may be good choices, but nonetheless, inevitably, one of them will be slightly or perhaps significantly more compassionate and life-affirming than the others. And that you will make, you pledge to, first of all, be aware you're making a choice, and second of all, of the options that are available to you to make the choice that is the most compassionate and life-affirming, and to tell 10 friends that you are doing it very consciously and invite them to join you, and for them in turn to go to 10 of their friends to do the same thing. And if we would do this, just starting with just the people listening to your show, we could change the course of the election. It's a mathematical certainty.
And I like the logic that you use here, because it seems clear to me that by doing so, we are overriding some of the financial and short-term quarterly profit statement-driven decision-making fiascos that have been, you know, driving the environment and much of our economy and so many things into crises as they are.
Yes. Forget about that. Forget about short-term profit. Forget about political parties. Forget about all that. It's very simple. Choose the thing which is the most compassionate and life-affirming as you understand it in that moment. That's it. And if you will do that, and you will tell others that you are doing it and invite them to do it, we can change the course of history. And let me give you some examples that we have all just lived through without really thinking about what was happening. Look at the difference in the choice of gay and replacing it with LGBT. Now, nobody passed a law that said that had to happen. No big public figure came out and made a pronouncement. The president didn't go on television and say, we're now going to say LGBT instead of gay. But if you look at if you go back and look at the Google word counts, you will find that about 15 months ago, people began making this choice. When they would say or write the word gay, they write LGBT instead. And that's not just a change in terminology. That's a change in concept, because it's a different way of looking at gender issues. Look at marriage equality. That's another one. Look at legalization of marijuana. That's another one. Look at the end of smoking in our lifetime. You know, when I was a boy and you went to somebody's house, on their coffee table, inevitably there would be a pack of cigarettes in an ashtray and one of those Ronson lighters. You don't see that anymore. Why not? Because thousands and thousands of perfectly ordinary people made small little quotidian choices during the course of their day. I'm not going to do this thing that I and most of the people I know used to do. It happens.
Well, something that I would love to have you think about or talk about a little bit is what's behind the 8 laws. We haven't gotten to them yet, but I'd love to know, when you wrote the book, the 8 laws of change, I was intrigued by your observation that every successful movement for social change begins with a few Quakers joining together in common intention. And I was just wondering how this amazing, interesting, fascinating fact came to your attention.
Well, I've been doing the research that led to the 8 laws of change for about 16 years. 4 times in my own life, as you noted in that little introduction you read, that I've been involved in social change, in changing history. And sometimes I've just been a spear carrier, a demonstrator at a civil rights thing. And my function was principally to get arrested, I think. And through the transformation in the American military, the citizen diplomacy movement of the 80s between the Soviet Union and the United States, through all of it, the consciousness movement. And so about 16 years ago, I began paying close attention to how successful life-affirming social change occurred. And I began doing research in the peer-reviewed literature, but I also began reading the biographies and the diaries and the correspondence of people who were involved in social changes. And what I discovered was that in most of the major positive social transformations that have occurred in the United States, I'm speaking here of abolition, penal reform, public education, women's suffrage, the environmental movement, the anti-nuclear movement, all of those movements, when you trace them back to their beginnings, go back to a small group of Quakers. Now, there are only about 87,000 Quakers in the country. We're a country of about 317 million people, and only about 87,000 of them are Quakers. So it's such a teeny tiny little group that very few people know who they are. They've never met one. They have no idea what they believe. They may know the name Quaker just because it's an unusual word. That most people don't know that the Society of Friends, their formal name, is the same thing as Quakers. So this teeny tiny little group, who most people don't even know exist, somehow when you track back to the major social transformations, going all the way back to the colonial period, you find that at their core, they began with a little group of Quakers. So I began to study the Quakers because more than any other organization of people, they figured out these 8 laws. And let me go through the 8 laws quickly, because I didn't invent these laws. What happened was as I did this research, both the peer-reviewed scientific research and the ethno-historical research, I kept coming into these same patterns. The same patterns would show up over and over again. And I began to realize as I tracked these things that those social movements which employed the 8 laws, they worked them out somehow, and they did it in different ways, But those movements which employed the eight laws, they were successful. And the movements that did not, who might be quite worthy, but who didn't get this, couldn't figure it out, they didn't succeed. So these eight laws are not at all what I would have thought. You know, I would have thought, well, you must get your funding straightened out, or you have to make powerful allies or things like that. Not, those are not the eight laws. So I'll just go through a few of them. Law number one, the individuals individually and the group collectively must share a common intention. Now, that seems very simple. But if you've ever been anybody who's ever worked on a committee to get anything done knows that getting a common intention that is shared equally by everybody is not an easy thing to do. But if you're going to be successful, you've got to do it. Law number two, the individuals and the group may have goals, but they may not have cherished outcomes. To give you an illustration of that, very few people in the United States know that Benjamin Franklin invented micro-lending and created the basis for all the philanthropy in the United States. In 1789, when Franklin came back from France, he was the most famous man in the world. He was the only founder to have signed all three of the foundational documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Paris, which was the end of the war, the Revolutionary War, and the Constitution. And he was much older than all the rest of the founders. So he comes back from Paris, and he's really in bad health. He knows he's dying. And he's sitting under his little mulberry tree in his house, in the garden of his house in Philadelphia. And he thinks to himself, how can I be of use to my, he says this, how can I be of use to my country in the future? How can I continue to create what he called virtuous citizens? And Franklin, uniquely amongst all the founders, is really the only one who would be at home in the modern day, because Franklin's vision of the United States was that it was going to be a middle-class, technologically sophisticated, entrepreneurial, family-centered, fun-loving country. That was his vision of it. And that its cities were going to be pretty, and they were going to have the benefit of good sanitation and good hospitals and good libraries and good fire departments. Very much like what we articulate today. Well, Franklin, that's what he cared about. So there he is in 1789, and he knows he's dying, and he's trying to figure out, well, what can I do to be of use to my country in the future? And he creates a codicil to his will. And in this, he says, I'm going to leave a sum of money equal to about $1 million today to Boston and to Philadelphia. And this money, half of the money is to be used to build parks and hospitals and sanitation and street lighting, that sort of thing, because people do better in cities which are hospitable and welcoming. And the other half of the money is to be used to be loaned at little micro loans to what he calls young married artificers, young married craftsmen who are just starting out, to give them the money to get their small businesses off the ground.
Well, I really love that example. And actually, it seems like it's a good example of both having a goal that's not necessarily a cherished outcome, but he was setting things up, but he didn't know what the future exactly would hold. But
precisely.
And I love that. As well as, and that says law number two. And then law number three, clearly Benjamin Franklin was setting things up so that these changes would not occur in his lifetime. It would be far beyond his lifetime.
That's right. Law number three, the individuals in the group must accept that their goal may not be reached in their lifetimes and be okay with that. And the law number four, which also illustrates what he did, the individuals in the group must accept that they may not get credit or acknowledgement for what they have done and be authentically okay with that. So what Franklin does is he sets up this micro-lending thing, this system, which is what the Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus got the Nobel Peace Prize for. Same thing. He sets up this system and he says it's to run for 100 years. Now, can you imagine a politician today thinking 100 years into the future? He says this is to run for 100 years, and then he appoints a committee. He says, I can't tell, you know, I don't know exactly what the needs will be, so I appoint this committee and I ask them only to follow my intention, my goal, which is to create virtuous citizens. But the cherished outcome of how to do that, I leave to them. And he says, and then it's to run for another 100 years.
But you raise a good question. Like, how can people learn to strategize like this too? I mean, if they have that kind of wealth and they can set up codicils to their wills, of course. But for people who might feel like right now they don't have that kind of a legacy, it's still, I love your book. It's so encouraging. Like you said, you don't need to start out with deep pockets, powerful friends. Anybody can make wonderful use of these 8 laws, and you've gone through 4 of them, but I'm just wondering, before we go through the rest of them, how is it that people could, for example, think in this long-term way that you're describing?
Well, you think about where you live and what your community is like, and you look for leverage points. You look for where the least amount of effort will produce the maximum amount of effect. For instance, I'll give you an example. Where I live, the women of my island have decided to create a social safety network, which has nothing to do with the government. Their idea was that if you have people have a decent quality of life, that the social disorders that plague so many communities will be, if not eliminated, at least significantly decreased. And so my wife, for instance, cooks 5 dozen organic treats every other week, which we send home. The children of low-income families who sign up for the program, they send the children home over the weekend with 2 grocery bags that are contributed by this volunteer group called Whidbey Island Nourishes. And it's just volunteer people who put in some time and a little bit of money. But the result is that we don't have hungry children. Now, you think, well, hungry children aren't a big problem in the United States. But the fact is we have 17 million children who have hunger issues. We have 2.5 million children, minor children, who are homeless in the richest country in the world. We got elder people who are eating dog food because they can't afford to get decent food and also get their medications. So this is not a rare thing. There are literally millions of people, young and old, who are affected by this. If you are an elder person on Whidbey Island, you can go and get a lunch every day. You know, you'd say, well, who's going to pay for all? It'll all cost so much and blah, blah, blah. In fact, the cost is very minimal. And as a result of treating these people not as second-class citizens, not as somebody who needs to be drug tested first or all those dreadful things that rightists want to inflict on people who are having a hard time, we treat them just as neighbors who are having a hard time.
And you know what? You've just mentioned law number 5, enjoy fundamental equality. So,
that's right.
So I think it's a great segue. I just couldn't help but mention that. And well, I love that, because you're right. When we don't judge people, who wants to be judged? You know, people need to be loved, respected. We have that human fundamental need. And
absolutely.
By recognizing that, then it can just, these 8 laws, in other words, are like puzzle pieces. When you start putting a few of them together, it seems like some of the rest of them start coming together. That's what I'm noticing, but I don't know if.
Well, if you look at, Cynthia, if you look at the successful social movements that you know about, you will discover that they have worked out in their own way these eight laws. And the net-net of what happens as a result is that not only are these movements successful, but, for instance, as in here on Whidbey, our social demographics and our social outcomes don't match. I mean, we have a large percentage of the population, a significant percentage, who are at or near the poverty line, and yet we don't have the spousal abuse, the drunkenness, the teenage acting out, the graffiti, the break-ins, the all of that sort of thing that you associate with having a disaffected low-income population. We don't have that.
And that you're mentioning number six here about forswearing all violence. It seems like, these look like puzzle pieces to me, because when you've got people such as this great group you mentioned, Whidbey Island Nourishes, and I don't know them, but I'm just presuming, obviously, they're not just thinking long term. They're looking at fundamental equality, which is number five. They're forswearing violence. And by keeping that positive intention within themselves, it seems like that might be a factor, perhaps, in reducing violence, as well as the fact that these children and their families are not suffering quite so badly, because at least they've got some more food and maybe other things to help with their monthly budget.
Yes, and not only, by the way, not only more food, but higher quality food. This is all organic. The food bank on South Island has a huge organic garden that people work in, and it gives them access so that they not only get food, but they get high quality food, because we know that if you look at childhood obesity, if you live on fast food and soft drinks, you're going to spend your entire life with a series of medical conditions that could have been avoided. So we try to create wellness. And that is the key, is that as you look at, well, what can I do? First of all, identify a leverage point. And second of all, do something that increases wellness. Because if you start social programs from the premise that their purpose is to increase wellness, not to make a profit, not to lord it over people, but to create wellness, you won't go far wrong. And the other thing, law number seven, is that you must be privately what you are publicly. And we all know endless stories of people who put themselves forward as moral leaders who turn out to be doing, sexually exploiting children or embezzling money or whatever. Your private self and your public self must be one and the same. And the final, the eighth law, the individuals in the group and the group collectively must always act from the beingness of life-affirming integrity.
Yes, I really appreciate your going through all eight of those. And it's worth, for people listening, if it seems like this is fabulous, how can I find out more? Well, obviously, it's from the book, Eight Laws of Change, which I highly recommend. And getting into this example, Benjamin Franklin, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I did not know the background behind all of his micro-lending. I didn't know that he'd had such an instrumental role. And obviously, by not worrying or being concerned about his own personal credit for having done so much, for getting Boston, for example, to be so well-equipped, as well as Philadelphia and other places, and just setting that model in place for how people can do this in the future, was extremely forward-thinking. So I really thank you for finding these examples. And that's just one of many in this book. And now I'd love to ask you a personal question. You've been saying so many things today, and you do so much good work in the world. I love your passion for helping to positively transform the world. So I'd love to know what you know for sure that many people don't seem aware of that has the power to improve our lives. And it might be something you've already said. You said several good things.
Well, the most important thing that I know about creating wellness is the quotidian pledge. And that is every day when I make a decision, I'm going to be aware I'm making a decision, and I'm going to, of the options available, I'm going to choose the compassionate and life-affirming one. And I mean, I just can't overemphasize that, because it is very clear when you look at the data, and I am a science-based person, a data person. I don't care really about political philosophies or polemics or any of that. I want to know, if you do this policy, what's the outcome? And what's very clear is that if you make wellness, will this produce more wellness? Wellness at the individual, the familial, the community, the national, and even the planetary. If you ask yourself, will this produce more wellness? It's pretty clear. I mean, I'll give you an example. My wife had a Saab station wagon, which she dearly loved. And it finally had so many miles on it that it had just run its course. So we went out to buy another car, and I had one car in mind, and she had another car in mind. And we went down and looked at these cars. And the first one we looked at, when we went into the station, into the dealership, it said 17 miles on in the city and 20 mile or 21 miles on the highway. And I said to her as we walked in, as soon as I saw that, we don't even need to test drive this car. This isn't the car. And the guy came out and you know, wanted to know if we wanted to go on a test drive. I said, no, we can't buy your car. In fact, I don't even think your car should be manufactured, because we know what carbon is doing to the atmosphere. So we went down the way and to the next car, and it was a Subaru, and we bought a Subaru Outback, because it gets 37 miles on the highway, and I've forgotten 27 or something in the city. Just that decision. Or I could give you another one. If you stop giving children soft drinks, we have all kinds of research now that shows that high sugar, high corn fructose soft drinks have all kinds of problems and produce all kinds of problems. So if you just made sure that little children didn't drink those drinks, just that alone, those little kind of things, the difference.
And here in Berkeley, I live in a fairly progressive city. That way we do have recent legislation that did stop the soft drink intrusion into schools, so that those sugary drinks are not made freely, but not made so readily available to school children here in the city of Berkeley. So if people are listening and thinking it's too big, I can't take on big multinational corporations, yes, you can, and it's doable. So, I really am a big believer in that as well. I've done some volunteer work here in Berkeley. So I agree, you know, get involved locally, just look around, see what you can do to help. And I've got another question for you, Stephen, because I love the way you write about what passes for thought in our waking hours is primarily unconscious reactive behavior.
Yes.
Little more than running the program until you fit them into the appropriate category so that a judgment can be made as to how to react to them.
Yep.
And we each have thousands of these little bots that run our lives.
Yeah, they're like little apps on our cell phone or little bots. Yes. I mean, they start early. Some of them are good. Some of them are not. I mean, you learn very early on, don't put your hand on a hot stove. I mean, you only do it once. And ever after that, for the rest of your life, when you see a stove, you're mindful of, is this a hot surface? So that's an example, I guess, of a good one. But we have thousands of them. We are taught, you know, how to react to a person of a different color or a different socioeconomic group or a different religion or whatever. So we get these things, this kind of programming. At the University of Chicago some years ago, they did a study which showed that most people have only 13 minutes of original thought during the course of a day. Everything else is reactive.
Oh, good Lord. That seems scary.
Well, it is scary because we're unconscious, and by using fear, it's possible to manipulate people so that they consistently vote against their own self-interest. And that you see that over and over again in a number of states.
And so how can we break through this little, the sort of sleepwalking problem that we've got going on? How can people break through this habituation of doing activities that are autopilot, basically?
Well, the most powerful way to do it is to develop the daily practice of meditation.
I would agree with that.
Not a religious, I mean, you can be a religious, but it doesn't have to be religious, doesn't have to have anything to do with religion. Mindfulness meditation training changes you in such profound ways. I mean, for one thing, it changes your brain. It increases your neuronal activity. It improves your memory, lowers your blood pressure, makes you sleep better, gives you a better sex life. I mean, there are just so many things. There are over 3,000 papers.
And it seems like it's growing. Every couple of weeks or months, there's another huge burst of new things that meditation, positive things that meditation is doing for us.
I mean, in San Francisco, for instance, they took the four worst schools in the system with the highest level of dropout and test score failure and all that. And by teaching a little 20-minute course for a non-sectarian, non-religious form of mindfulness training, just that, in these four schools, they completely transformed the schools. I mean, this is all reported in, as I said, in the research literature. So if you want to change yourself, the best gift that you can give yourself is to develop the daily practice of meditation. It doesn't really matter how you do it. In the book, I give a technique for a non-sectarian form of meditation, but it's a way. It's not the way. There is no the way. But taking just 20 minutes a day, and I want to tell you, it's easy to do it once. It's much harder to do it continually. But I tell people, if you will do it faithfully for 90 days, it will change your life. I guarantee it.
And I second that. I totally agree with you, and both from my own personal experience and those that I've guided through meditation. So this is a great segue. I hope you don't mind if I bring up some of your prior work as well, because my fascination has to do with consciousness primarily. And of course, consciousness is a huge part of Eight Laws of Change. But also just through the body of work that you've done and some of your prior writings and books, for example, your book Secret Vaults, you've done quite a bit of work with what's called psychic archaeology. And the thing that's so interesting to me, and it correlates also with Eight Laws of Change, is that clearly there is a non-local consciousness at work. It's readily apparent to a lot of us who have been researching this or at least reading research reports, and you yourself have been pretty involved. So I would love to hear anything you might say about maybe introducing psychic archaeology to people who don't know what it is, why it's important. But you've previously mentioned this is an extremely important way for us to know ourselves.
I wouldn't call it psychic. I wouldn't use that word anymore. When I wrote that book, I was still using that word, but I wouldn't use it because it has too many, too much emotional baggage, occultism and new ageism. And so what I would say, Cynthia, is that I am one of the people who developed a protocol called remote viewing, or a series of protocols. Remote viewing is the ability to describe persons, places, events, or objects from which you are shielded by reason of either time or space or both. And a typical example would be, I'm going to show you a picture an hour from now, and I'd like you to describe it for me. I don't know what the picture is because it hasn't been selected yet, but it will be after you give me the information. And we know in this that this research, and in fact there are now 6 protocols used in laboratories around the world, as well as things like near-death research and also research in the neurosciences, which are telling us that consciousness is causal and fundamental, and that there is an aspect of consciousness which is not physiologically based. You know, the prevailing paradigm is dead meat, no consciousness. When the body dies, consciousness dies. But in fact, the research overwhelmingly suggests that that is not true. And that consciousness, you had consciousness before you were born, and you will have consciousness after you're dead physically. And that we are, there is a part of us that is, if not immortal, eternal, but anyway, that it seems to exist across many lifetimes. That's research, not religion.
Right. And it matches closely with what I've been observing in 16 years of research, of noticing transformation of so-called, you know, solid physical reality based on states of consciousness. So I'm right there with you. And a lot of people listening to the show, hopefully they've seen my website, and so they're right there also. But I'm curious, because you've done so much trend watching for remote viewing, especially with pertaining to a certain year. I understand at one point you were looking at the year 2050.
Yes.
And I'd love to know if there's anything of interest that you've noticed with changes in the way that's been viewed or what you've been tracking there.
Well, the first thing, I started doing the 2050 stuff in 1978. I've now had over 4,000 people do it. And the world that they described, which isn't at all what I thought it would be, so far every major thing they've told me has come true. I mean, I started in 1978 because I had just left government, where I had spent a great deal of time looking at the potential for nuclear war, and was very concerned we were going to blow ourselves up. So I started getting people to review, to do 2050. The reason I chose 2050 is if you get too far out, you can't understand what they're saying. It doesn't make any sense. So I figured 2050 was just far enough out that I was right out on the edge. I could understand what they were saying. And they said to me, just to give you a few of their predictions, the Soviet Union would disappear, which I thought was, I had no idea what that meant. You know, do space people are going to come down and gather that section of Earth up and take it away? I mean, what do you mean the Soviet Union's going to disappear? But of course, that's what happened. They also told me, I said, well, then the world must be a safer place. And they said, oh, no, the world is much more dangerous. And I said, why? And they said, because of the rise of terrorism. They told me that epidemics would sweep across the earth, and that the first one would be an epidemic crossing over from primates in Africa that was a blood disease that would kill millions. And, of course, it's AIDS. So I take what they said very seriously. The world that they describe in 2050 is very different than the world we have today, because climate change is now well underway. Hundreds of cities are now going underwater. There are massive migrations because water is destiny. There's either too much of it or too little of it. And as a result, social instability is a huge problem. There are literally tens of millions of people moving across the earth as a result of climate change, and particularly the water issue, either too much or too little. All of that is happening. I mean, you can see it happening today. The UN estimates about 50 million people are refugees as a result of water issues.
Now, you've been in a unique position with tracking the social and scientific trends, just reading the reports that you're constantly observing with the Schwartz Report, as well as benefiting from these remote viewing people who have taken a look at the future. So you're much more than the average futurist in that sense. And I'd love to know, you know, because you've got, it's almost like left brain, right brain information coming in together. Is there anything that, does it seem to you that we can change things? And I know you've written this whole book, Eight Laws of Change. Obviously, you believe it's possible. Have you seen that kind of change happening with the remote viewers? Or
Yes. The remote viewers describe trends which I can now see very clearly. For instance, they, beginning in the late 70s into the early 80s, they were describing this big transition out of carbon into non-carbon energy. they describe the rise of local community programs as becoming increasingly important. They talk about the re-tribalization of peoples, that subgroups within countries are increasingly at odds and are struggling to find ways to get on with one another. And I would say that the assimilation of minorities, for instance, and gender equality, which is another thing that they told me about, are two of the great trends of the 21st century. How a nation deals with migrations, with immigration, and how it deals with gender equality is going to have a big effect on how it prospers in this century. They told me, and you can see it happening. I mean, you just look at the happiness index, for instance, between the difference between, Norway, which is the happiest country, Switzerland, Finland, Denmark. And you look, for instance, at the United States, which not only doesn't rank very well in terms of healthcare, but doesn't rank very well in terms of overall happiness and life satisfaction. So I can see positive things happening. I think we're watching solar, for instance, take off in a really serious way. Wind. I think we're seeing changes in medicine that are very profound. We're going to see the demise of antibiotics because of the rise of superbugs. A very painful period for us. So there are both good trends and bad trends. And the takeaway for both of these, again, is individuals must choose to serve wellness, not money. You can make all the money you want by creating wellness, and great fortunes will be made by creating wellness. But the key is that we as individuals must select for wellness.
And that's really waking up, is what I would say, because it's coming out of a bad dream where we're poisoning ourselves with things like sugar and soda pop and sometimes EMF fields. We have this addiction to these electromagnetic devices and sometimes don't know what we're doing with that. So it can be overwhelming for people to make a good choice when they're comparing an electric car. Maybe they can't ride in it because they've become electrosensitive. So these choices can be difficult, but I hear what you're saying, and it's possible to take each choice one at a time and make it a better one.
Yes. Yes, we can do this. That's the takeaway. We can do this.
And I'm encouraged by the fact that you've been doing this remote viewing. Have you thought about looking farther ahead now that it's no longer 1978? Maybe we could look further out. I don't know if you've considered doing that.
Well, I could start, somebody asked me that the other day, would I start it up again and look even further into the future? And I might do that. I've been thinking about that, and maybe I will. Maybe I will take that up, because the 2050 stuff, so far, all of it has been right on target.
That's right. And now we're really close. It's not so far from here.
Yes, exactly.
But if you look another 75 years from now, for example, a lot of people are anticipating it's possible that there may be something called a singularity, where all of this consciousness comes together in the form of artificial intelligence, or the ability for something to have a consciousness equivalent to a human being. And it's something that I don't know when that's supposed to happen. And it's an open question. We've got quantum computers on the horizon. Lots of people are anticipating potential risks and dangers, of course, with, once again, humans getting involved in something where we don't know what we're doing. Do you have any thoughts about that, or has that come up in the remote viewing?
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think, because I don't think consciousness is fundamentally materialistic, it's not physicalist, I don't think we're going to see artificial intelligence in which genuine consciousness is present, although it may be such, you know, the Turing test, it may be such a close approximation that in most instances you won't be able to tell the difference. But I would think it would be a grave misjudgment to allow machines to decide what is the path of wellness for human beings. I think what we're going to, I actually think we're going to see something quite different. Almost all of the projections into the future that you see in the movies or in books and are about mechanistic, structured societies. You know, it's lots of machines and not much green, and just look at any movie. I think we're actually going to be quite different. In order to get through climate change, we are going to have to learn that we don't live on the earth. We do not have dominion over the earth. We need to give up these sort of Iron Age warlord stories that dominate our culture and recognize that we don't live on the earth. We live in the earth. We live in the Goldilocks zone. There's life miles above our heads and miles below our feet. And we live on the Goldilocks zone on the surface. And that if we're going to survive, let alone thrive, in the future, we're going to have to learn to work with the Earth's great meta systems and to recognize, as Max Planck said, the father of quantum mechanics, not only is consciousness causal and fundamental, but we live locked into a matrix of consciousness. We are one part of it, not all of it. And we're going to have to learn to work with the great living systems of the earth. And so I think the future is going to be much more like, what was the movie, Avatar? Yes. It's going to be much more like Avatar than it is like Star Trek.
So this is very much coming home. And this brings us to the end of a wonderful, wonderful interview. I'd love to know, as we close, how can our audience find out more about your work?
Well, you can go to my website, www.schwartzreport.net, where I do a daily trend analysis. You can go to my personal website, www.stephanieschwartz.com, or you can go to academia.edu or ResearchGate, on one word, where you can get my papers. And I've got, I don't know, 100 papers up there. So you can get all of my material. I make it all freely available. And my books, of course, you can get off Amazon.
Well, thank you so very much. It's been such a pleasure. And I'm looking forward to staying in touch and finding out what you come up with next.
My pleasure, Cynthia. Okay.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson of RealityShifters.com. Join Cynthia next time in visualizing and accessing whole new worlds of possibility on Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age. Heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.